From WXXI News, this is Connections. I'm Evan Dawson. Our connection this hour was made when you sat down on your couch to watch an episode of your favorite, well, I guess we still call them TV shows, streaming shows, but maybe it's on Netflix, Hulu, or another streaming service, or maybe it is on broadcast or cable TV. According to a Morning Consult Hollywood Reporter poll from last year, 60% of adults surveyed said they watched two or more consecutive episodes of the same show at least once a week. 15% of those viewers say they binge watch shows every day. And if you're like, who's doing every day? Who's got time for that? Now, if you're like them, you might soon find that finding shows on demand could be less easy than it is today. And that's because Netflix, Hulu, Disney, and other platforms have or will soon drop episodes of some series weekly rather than all at once. Netflix announced last week it would switch to a weekly release model for a new competition series called Rhythm and Flow. The idea is to prevent spoilers related to the winner. There was some confusion over Netflix's announcement, with some news sources reporting broad headlines that implied that Netflix's new strategy in general is a weekly release model. But Netflix is responding that that's not the case, and that it showed the Great British Baking Show has always been released weekly due to terms in its licensing deals. But Disney recently announced that its Disney Plus streaming service will follow a weekly release schedule. Hulu and Apple want to move toward more so-called appointment viewing as well. Is it a good idea? Could binge watching and spoilers become a thing of the past? Well, probably not, but those are the questions making headlines in recent weeks. And this hour, we've got a conversation about television and streaming viewing habits and how they could be changing. What could they mean for TV culture and production? And what are the shows that you can't miss? Well, I'd like to talk a little bit about what's good right now. Maybe get some ideas on what we ought to be watching. With our guests in studio, we have Todd Sedano, who's an associate professor of media and communication at St. John Fisher College. Todd, welcome back to the program.
Thanks, Evan.
And also with us on the line is Bob Thompson, the director of the Bleier Center for Television and Popular Culture at the Newhouse School at Syracuse University. Bob, welcome. How are you?
I'm doing very well. Thank you.
Well, I'll start with Todd in studio, and I'm just going to ask the first sort of broad-based question, which I've been wondering for a long time, ever since streaming kind of started, which is, if you were creating shows, would you want people to watch via binge or for weekly? In other words, can you really get as much as a viewer if you're binging versus watching maybe week by week? Todd?
That's a complicated question, because if you're coming at it from a creator's point of view, you want the eyeballs, right? You want people watching. You want people paying attention. You want people talking about it, tweeting about it, getting on social, talking about that stuff. If you're the network, if you're the distribution platform, that's what you want. If you're a viewer, sure, you may want to binge, but for reasons I imagine we'll talk about this hour, that goes away after a while. Who's mentioning Stranger Things a couple of weeks later? Not many of us, right? Or not as many when it first dropped. So it's complicated. It depends on if you're a creator, what kind of storyteller you are.
That's actually something, for some reason, I had not thought about. I mean, I certainly thought about it from the viewer's perspective. Are you talking week by week about a show, you know, whether it's Game of Thrones or something else, versus, like you said, Stranger Things, where there may be a surge, and there is when it comes out, a surge of interest, but within days or maybe a few weeks, it's much dissipated. Very interesting. So, listeners, we want to hear from you this hour as to your habits and the way you prefer to consume and what you think is good. Bob, do you think that there's a difference in sort of the quality of experience from binge versus more appointment week-to-week viewing?
There is. There are completely different ways of viewing, and one has to find the right spot to do it. I think television has become more like the novel now. You know, back in the day, every television episode was completely independent of the other. It pushed reset at the end. You could watch them out of order. It didn't matter. That isn't the case anymore. TV is more novelistic. And I think in many ways, and it's one of the reasons why Netflix is doing this and will continue to do it in spite of the British Baking Show and a couple of other things they're doing it, is that there is nothing quite like a good binge experience. I remember the first time I discovered Breaking Bad, and I had been on for quite a few episodes, and there is nothing like watching five episodes in a row of that. The Wire, of which Todd Sedano is a world-class expert in, I'm probably on my fifth viewing of that, and every time I watch it, It gets a little better, and that is a show that is best watched in chunks of 3 or 4 hours at a time. It's like reading a novel. You wouldn't want to just read one chapter every night. It'd take you forever to get through Moby Dick or War and Peace or a regular novel, for that matter. However, there is a point of diminishing returns. I much think it's a greater experience to be able to watch shows in big chunks. At the same time, if you get into the 6th or 7th hour, there does become a point, just like if you get into the 6th or 7th hour of reading a book, that you cease to absorb it in the way you did in the first 5 hours. Plus the fact you lose your job and your kids don't eat.
So, Todd, you want to add to that? You agree?
Well, not to the part about kids not eating. That would be terrible. Although Bob and I are complicit in all of this because we're the ones who are educating, you know, today's youth and getting them excited about these shows. And they show up in my classes as well as they show up in Bob's saying, hey, I just binged The Wire in 1 month, 61-hour episodes. But what Bob is talking about here and the questions, Evan, that you're asking are really important ones in terms of where this conversation is going, because it's important that we recognize, yeah, there was some kind of confusion about Netflix releasing some of these shows week to week, because as they clarified, they said to the effect that, look, we were releasing this stuff week to week anyway, but we may explore this stuff in the future. We may look at this kind of distribution. And what I think is interesting is this could be a pivotal time in television culture where we might be going back. I mean, this seemed to be a sea change in terms of how we were getting our shows. The full drop, as they call it, where all 8 episodes, all 13 episodes, would be dropped on that particular distribution platform. Except now they're saying, maybe let's go back to the way we used to have it, which is what Disney Plus might be doing, which is what Hulu might be doing. And then Netflix, who knows if they're pushed against the wall, how they're going
to
respond.
Yeah, and to the point that Todd was making earlier, Bob, really, this decision is ultimately going to be made not by what's good for the viewer or what the artists want, but by what's going to make more money, right?
Well, what's going to, I mean, it used to be everything was how many people you got to watch a show. In the network era, you made money by the number of people who were watching, the ratings. That isn't the case with a lot of these services now. It isn't how many people are watching. It's how many subscribers keep their subscriptions and then how many new subscribers are convinced to subscribe. HBO, Netflix, Hulu, they could care less if nobody is watching any of their shows at any given time. That's not how they make money. What they do care about is keeping their number of subscribers and getting more subscribers. And I think they realize that a lot of people, for example, with the binging thing, Hulu does a lot of the kind of hybrid. They have the new Wu-Tang Clan docudrama on, Wu-Tang, an American Saga. They released 3 episodes of the, I think there's going to be 10 of them, at one point, and I consumed them voraciously all at one time, and then I realized that I was going to have to wait for the rest of them. And as a spoiled consumer used to the era of Netflix, I resented that. There was almost a sense of anger that why can't I watch the rest of these episodes? And I think that's happened with a lot of people. They got used to the ability to keep going at their own pace, and when that isn't offered to them, they don't have any other choice. But they sometimes get upset about that because the idea of watching these things where you program when the episode plays is something that an awful lot of people, especially younger viewers, have really gotten used to. If Netflix announced today that from now on they were going to do only weekly releases, they'd get more complaints than they did when they announced that they weren't going to show Friends anymore.
Yeah, there'd be pure chaos. And I'm glad Bob's mentioning Friends and The Office, because those are the two most popular shows on Netflix right now.
Right, for all this fancy stuff, what are people watching? Shows from the 90s.
Well, The Office was the aughts, I think. But yeah.
By the way, did anyone see the Office Smell-O-Vision episode that Cozy TV did last week?
Did not.
No, it did not.
Did not.
You could go on their Facebook thing and they'd send you a card and you could watch one of their classic episodes and it was scratch and sniff.
Oh, my God.
Talk about old school.
Yeah, that is old school.
John Waters was doing that with polyester back in 1981.
We should do a whole separate hour, and don't worry, listeners, we're not going to do this right now, but premised on several questions about Friends. Was it ever funny? Does it hold up? And should it be viewed as a national embarrassment? Those are the three questions, but that's a whole separate hour.
I think Evan has his thumb on the scale
already. By the way, is yes.
Yes. So listeners, don't come at me for Friends hate. That was Bob Thompson who said, yeah, all I did was ask the question.
Well, the first two questions were actually love. It was the third question that was hate.
Okay. Well, look, I want to flip this a little when it comes to the way we talk about binge or appointment viewing, because I was not a Game of Thrones watcher. So I want to ask both of you, and I'll start with you, Todd, on this. What do you think would have been different about the way this country, to the extent that there was this national sort of interest in Game of Thrones? And for listeners who are like, well, I didn't watch Game of Thrones. Somebody close to you was watching it and obsessing over it, and I'm sure there are plenty. But what do you think would have been different about the experience, the conversations that happened, had it been bingeable as opposed to appointment?
Right off the bat, if people had binged on Game of Thrones, at least the final season, no one would have cared about the stupid Starbucks cup in the corner of the bar or the water bottle under somebody's chair.
That's such a good point.
Because people would have focused on the stories. They would have focused on the plots a little more intently, as they should have. Except they didn't. And this is the problem with when you wait week to week. And I'm that kind of viewer who still loves that experience, that week to week. The anticipation, the conversations, the talking to a buddy. Hey, did you watch the most recent Succession episode? Let's talk about it. But as soon as you binge, you're on a completely different page from that person. Because as one writer was writing about, I think it was an NPR writer a few years ago, was saying, everything is a spoiler and nothing is a spoiler. So as far as Game of Thrones is concerned, people maybe would have focused more on the entire story as a corpus rather than just one at a time. Which seemed to be problematic because they were focusing on maybe the wrong things.
Oh, that's interesting. Okay, Bob, what do you think?
That everything Todd just said, I think, is entirely true. The fact that it was released season to season, week to week, and by the way, they took their time. There were times when they would, that show, I think, was off the air for more than 2 years at one point, wasn't it?
Yeah, but there's history of that, right? I mean, The Wire had
Sopranos,
a 2.5-year hiatus.
21 months, right?
Sopranos,
right.
Same thing.
Yeah. So it would have been it's true. If these would have been dropped all at one time, it doesn't stretch out that conversation, and it doesn't allow the old, you know, Ed Sullivan effect that we all get to watch the same things at the same time, and the whole spoiler issue as well. I think back. Remember Lost?
Of course.
Lost was this, you know, show that it was so interesting. It was so complex. It was like nothing we'd ever seen before. And then, of course, in the end, it completely betrayed us. It completely didn't do anything that it needed to do to end well. It would have been like if Moby Dick had ended four chapters earlier than it did. And I wonder if Lost would have come out back in the day of dropping full episodes, if in fact that final episode would have kind of destroyed the desire for anybody to go back and binge it. And I think that's an interesting question, as opposed to Breaking Bad, which was slowly but surely gaining its audience. Breaking Bad became a masterpiece in the minds of most people, not who watched it on its original airings that were done weekly on AMC. It was, as they started hearing all the great things about it as it went to its final season, people went to Netflix and were watching that thing four, five, six episodes at a time, which, by the way, is, I think, the way God meant Breaking Bad to be watched. And by the time that show got to its final season, it had garnered this huge audience thanks to this secondary binge watching. So I guess, you know, binge or not binge, it kind of depends on the program, sort of.
I like the idea of thinking about God caring about binge versus weekly appointment viewing, the things that matter.
God cares about everything.
I love it.
God's Team Pinkman in the Breaking Bad world. Right.
Oh, my gosh.
So, but also to Bob's point about a show like Breaking Bad, here's a show that at the end of its fourth season, it was on the air for six seasons, earned 1.9 million viewers on AMC, which by AMC standards is fantastic.
but by network standards is statistically insignificant.
Yeah, you're about to be canceled, right? So by the time the show ends, it had more than 10 million viewers. I mean, if you do the math, we're talking over a 400% increase in ratings, which is unfathomable.
And that was thanks to Netflix, not thanks to AMC, interestingly enough.
Which is an important point. That's the point to make, right? To the binge point Bob's making.
So there's something sort of synergistic about the two ways of doing it? Is that kind of the point, Todd?
Yeah. I mean, you also look at Netflix, and I wonder if it's at not a crossroads or a turning point, but even its brand seems to still be a little confusing. Like, are they designed for binge viewing? Is it supposed to be the old sitcoms like Bob's talking about with Friends and The Office? Is it supposed to be about original programming? I mean, they're paying $15 billion this year just for the original programming, and they're not making any of it back yet. They're still losing money. They're losing cash. They're investing about $3 billion in marketing. They did $12 billion in programming last year. And yet they're signing these huge names. I mean, you got people like Shonda Rhimes, Jenji Cohen, Kenya Barris. All these studs from network television are now being gobbled up by Netflix, including the creators of Game of Thrones, Benioff and Weiss. Those two guys are going to Netflix.
Including President Barack Obama.
What's he producing or creating?
He's got a whole deal with they just came out with he's acquiring documentaries and got some original stuff. One on Frederick Douglass coming. Higher Ground Productions. This is he and Michelle are running it together.
But Bob, to Todd's point, you know, they're gobbling up all of these big names, and yet it's not necessarily, at least at this point, a cash cow or a net cash cow for them. So what does it portend about the future of what Netflix is and what our viewing habits may be, the way we consume?
Okay, so that's a really good point. We should remember that when radio started doing production of new programming way back in the late 20s, they weren't making any money. They were trying to get people to buy radios. When television started, all the money was in radio, and they were just putting programming on, hoping that people would eventually get televisions. Netflix's major goal right now, and they've got to have one because they're obviously not in the business to lose money, which they're doing, as you point out, on a net level. But they want to get a bench of programming so deep that there is something on Netflix that, you know, that everybody cannot live without. Not a single programming like in the old network days, but that there's so much on Netflix that everybody has something on there that they can't live without. Because Netflix is spending all this money in preparation for the day when they're not the only game in town, which they kind of were for streaming back in the Game of Thrones, Orange is the New Black 2013, ye olden days. But they know that Disney is going to have their own stuff. CBS now is going to have their own stuff. NBC Universal, AT&T, Hulu. They're going to be one of many, many streaming services. And the one way they can guarantee that they keep their audience is if they've got a big backlog of programs that they have control over. And I think that's why they're spending way more than they're making. That's an investment in this future that's going to change as early as November. This Disney thing is going to completely alter the whole equation.
Bob, let me ask you a question then. If we're looking at something like Netflix here, and since you know this better than anybody, has there ever been a moment in television where something that has been revolutionized, such as this scheduling paradigm over the last handful of years, could actually revert back to the way it was?
All right, this is kind of a lame answer, but NBC introduced color in like 1954, and they started putting up a bunch of color programming, and nobody bought color TVs. And it wasn't until 1965 that we went above the 3% mark of color, so 10 years later. 3D TV, remember when that became, they were selling 3D televisions and all this kind of thing, and that didn't really go anywhere. So we've had these kind of bursts. But if you're asking me whether I think Netflix is going to go back to, as they promised they are not, to, you know, no longer doing these, you know, season drops all at once, I don't think we are going to go back to that. I think we're going to have, we've got so many different things. I think we're going to have some places that do them week at a time, because if nothing else, the production requires that. I don't think Game of Thrones could have managed to make all of those shows at one time. And I think we're going to have a hybrid of all of this stuff at once, and people will watch it accordingly. The big revolution is going to be, when you're a 25-year-old and you only have a certain amount of money you can afford for television, which of these many services are you going to pay for? I don't know how many times I heard the joke from stand-ups, from students, from everybody else saying, I'm so glad Game of Thrones is ending, not because I care how it ends, but because then I can cancel my HBO subscription. That is really bad news for not only HBO, but that kind of thinking is bad news for any of these streaming services who are going to be constantly vulnerable to the fact that you can only afford so much television.
Yeah, and in our second half hour, listeners, we're going to talk about what our guests think is good right now. But to Bob's point, you know, shows like Barry on HBO are really good, but it takes something special to get a big portion of the population, big enough, that says, I'm literally going to have HBO because of this show. Barry ain't it, even though Barry's great, whereas the Game of Thrones was in that category. And so just to kind of tie up on the Game of Thrones thing, I'm going back to kind of what Todd said about the way we thought about and viewers of Game of Thrones thought about the show week to week and the things that the viewers fixated on. And Bob, you and I have talked about this in the past, but you and I share the opprobrium for the ending of Lost, right? That's been well documented. Now, one of the most defensive people about that is going to be Damon Lindelof, understandably so. He's the creator of the show. And, you know, he didn't say a whole lot about that opprobrium in the years after. And then in 2015 or 2016, he did an interview where he basically said, I'm tired of this. I'm only going to do this one time. Here's what everybody got wrong. Here's what all of this stuff about, oh, it was heaven, blah, blah. So he goes deep on it. And I have to say, as a hater, it turned me a little. I think it was a pretty good defense, even if I think overall the ending is still a disappointment. However, part of where I'm going to is this. Lindelof makes the point that with all of the expectation, all the pressure, solve every mystery, make it the most meaningful thing ever, that you could never deliver what the audience wanted or what the audience hoped it would be.
He's right about that.
And that's how I think about sort of Game of Thrones. Even though I wasn't watching Game of Thrones, I was very aware week to week in this last season, people were worried about the coming war and who was going to die and how was it going to play out and was it going to be executed interestingly. And then there was disappointment and this all happened too fast or this didn't make sense. And why would this woman nuke all the people with the dragon and when she already had the power? Look, see, I know a little bit of stuff. And there was so much pressure that I thought of Lindelof saying, you know what? I could never please all of you people. Week to week, there's so much pressure. And if it were binged, maybe that would be less so. I'll start with Bob. Would that have been the case if it were Game of Thrones or Lost, that it would have been less pressure week to week, month to month, to give me the greatest thing ever?
Okay, very quickly, and I know you got to go to break. But first of all, with
Game of Thrones, hey, we're public. We break when we want, Bob.
Game of Thrones. I think if you put on a show that's got dragons, by the time you get to the end of that series, those dragons have to push the nuclear button. And they did. So in many ways, I think Game of Thrones was kind of true to what Game of Thrones was all about. There was a lot of stupid stuff with that little, you know, that whole detente that they had at the end. Going back to Lindelof and Lost, though, Lost was an ABC show. It was trying to appeal to this enormous audience. And he can say, yeah, no, you can't please everybody. But that would be like if I gave a really spectacular resume and I got the job and I turned out then not to have these skills and I couldn't do this and I wasn't good at managing. They said, well, you can't please anybody. What would be the response to that? They would fire me. And I think what was so brilliant about Lost is it was this Rubik's Cube. It was this complex game. And the one thing that it kept promising is, won't this be almost physically pleasant when it finally all slams into place? And then it didn't slam into place. So I read that interview you're talking about, but it I don't know. I think the whole purpose of that show was to do something that, I agree with Lindelof, he could not possibly have delivered. And that's like, it's like inviting a bunch of people over for a fabulous meal that you can't cook.
If I can be the third person here who I think read this interview with Lindelof,
yeah.
I don't know, it might have been a Hollywood Reporter piece or something, but his subsequent show, The Leftovers on HBO, I think he said it was liberating for him to know that he couldn't do anything as bad as that Lost finale, which kind of freed him. And I'm paraphrasing here.
I think he's being cheeky, though.
Yeah.
I don't think he thought it was bad. I think he's joking that the public thought it was bad.
Right, which
yeah.
freed him up to write the show that he wanted in The Leftovers and have the finale that he wanted in The
That's
Leftovers.
That's fascinating. And I will say this about when I watched the Lost finale live, I will confess to this. While I was watching it, I thought it was one of the greatest final episodes ever. I really, really liked it. And then every hour that passed, as I thought about it, and I thought about the whole series and everything, I liked it less. And by the following morning, I thought it was the worst final episode ever.
It was the television. It's the television equivalent of a Malcolm Gladwell book. You put it down and you go, that is brilliant. And then you just start thinking about it. You go, no, absolutely, that's oversimplified. That is, and then you go, okay, that could have been interesting, and it wasn't. And by the way, again, listeners, I joke about Gladwell. I actually think he's hit and miss. But the television show, I agree with Bob. The more time you had to think about it, the more you went, boy, that was a cop-out, it was a dodge, it was sort of
what
lazy.
Happens when the reverse happens, which will be an hour that Evan's going to produce another day about the Seinfeld finale, yeah. which I think is misunderstood, where I thought it was actually
what?
A very good finale.
I agree with Todd entirely.
No
on
way.
Yeah,
you're the only two people I've ever met with any credibility who are going to defend the Seinfeld. Okay, so, all right, real briefly, give me the quick piece of it. Why are you defending Seinfeld as the finale?
These were four horrible people who got their comeuppance, and they were then brought in front of an audience of those people whom they wronged over the years to show them what horrible people they were. So why not do that? I mean, it was a stroke of genius on Larry David's
part. It ended with dialogue from the first episode, which demonstrated that in all those years, they had not learned anything.
And that's what they said. Bob knows this too. They said this, no hugging, no learning. That was the motto of the show.
It was the exact correct. To me, some of the greatest episodes are the ones that the audiences have hated most. Seinfeld was one of them. St. Elsewhere was one of them. And The Sopranos was the perfect episode, even though it was incredibly unsatisfying. Sex and the City was a satisfying final season that betrayed everything the show was about. So The Sopranos was an incredibly artistic ending that was incredibly unsatisfying.
Well said.
Okay. And I have to say, it's a pretty compelling Seinfeld argument defending the finale. So before I go to break, and in our second half hour, listeners, again, we're going to ask them what they like now. And listeners, if you want to weigh in on your habits, if they've changed or if you appreciate the way viewing has changed, if there's something that you do or don't like that's on there now, we'll take some of your feedback. Connections at WXXI.org, or you can give us a call. But Bob, why do you think the Seinfeld finale is viewed with so much hate? Again, for me, it goes back to the Lindelof quandary, which is, you know, for Lindelof, a cop-out, but there is this idea that when there's this much buildup, you probably cannot please people.
Okay, I think that was the major thing. That they started the drum roll of that thing at the beginning of the final season, and there had been so many classic episodes. Seinfeld was such a masterpiece in so many different ways that I think everybody wanted that final episode to be the best episode ever. And that was really, really hard to do. Secondly, I think it went way too long. It was extended. They brought everybody back, the soup Nazi and all the rest of it. It was like watching an old-timers game where everybody puts on the Bengay and takes one more slice at the ball. But I think it was that expectation. But I do think it was different than Lost, in that Lost didn't do what the entire series was making us wait for it to do. As much as people didn't like the final episode of Seinfeld, fine, they didn't like that episode, but they can still like all the other great episodes. The show still holds up. It wasn't like everything in that series was moving toward a final episode as it would be in a serialized kind of thing like Lost or Game of Thrones or whatever.
It seems like our expectations are shifting, too, in terms of what we're looking for in a series finale. Are we wanting that explosive one like we might have seen with Sopranos or Breaking Bad? Or are we just looking for something that's going to be satisfying? And that seems to be the bar that we've hit, because it sounds kind of benign if we say that a show had a satisfying finale. It's not going to vex the person sitting next to you who has a completely different take. And I think that's kind of bad for TV storytelling.
Todd, what's the best finale of all time?
I'm gonna punt and say, what do you mean by best?
All right, Bob, what's the best of all time?
Nice. He's going to say Saint Elsewhere.
Todd Sedano.
Bob's going to say Saint Elsewhere. And I'm not going to say The Wire, Bob.
I am going to say Saint Elsewhere. I really love the final episode of 6 Feet Under. I really love the final episode of The Wire. Todd's the expert in that. But the one that really got us started, forget The Fugitive, that was early, but the one that really got us started was The Mary Tyler Moore Show in 1977. People really didn't do final episodes before that. Episodes, the last episode was the same as the other. And it was that final episode of The Mary Tyler Moore Show that really got people to think, you know, not only can we sum these things up, but we probably should. So that one has is a fond memory. What everybody always names is the Newhart finale, which that turns out that the entire series of Newhart was a dream of Bob Newhart in the Bob Newhart Show, his previous one. That was funny. It was clever, but it was just a gag. So I wouldn't call that the greatest ever.
Okay, Todd.
Bob, thanks for loosening the pickle jar and making me remember the 6 Feet Under finale. Claire Fisher driving in her car down the road.
Wasn't that beautiful?
The future. Yeah, that was just extraordinary.
Okay. We're talking about the way our viewing habits are, have changed, but also what Netflix and other services are doing in regards to the way they drop shows. And there will at least be a little less of the bingeable shows. Netflix announcing that at least its competition shows are going to be released week to week, but not necessarily all the shows. Disney, Hulu, there's some debate about whether there's going to be a change in that and what that would mean for the way we view. And we're also talking about what's good with Todd Sedano, Associate Professor of Media and Communication at St. John Fisher College, and Bob Thompson, Director of the Bleier Center for Television and Popular Culture at the Newhouse School at Syracuse University. They are actually defending the Seinfeld finale, but not Lost. So it's an interesting hour. It's a hit and miss. We'll be right back. Coming up in our second hour, have you tried keto? It's one of the most popular diets in the country, and there are plenty of people, you've probably heard them in your circle of friends, talking about the benefits of the ketogenic diet. But what do doctors say? What do the experts say? What do people who study our bodies say about the impact of keto, short and long term? We explore the evidence next hour. Well, there is something close to unanimity about what is good, with our listeners telling us that Dairy Girls tops the list. And I got to say, I'm with the listeners on this. I don't watch a ton of streaming or television, but I've seen all 12 episodes, 2 seasons of Dairy Girls. I think it's phenomenal. Bob Thompson, have you seen it?
Oh, yeah.
Did you have to watch it with closed captioning? That is a heavy Irish set of accents, but it's phenomenal. Did you?
It is. And I like the idea that programming that requires you to not be checking your email while you watch it. You really got to pay attention to it. And especially if you're watching, I think Americans are slowly but surely learning how to read subtitles, for example, not only because we're getting more and more shows from countries not in English, but we're getting more and more shows with subtitles from this country.
Well, so, and do you agree with the consensus of Connections audience that Dairy Girls should be watched, Bob?
Oh, yes.
Okay.
No, I've not
no
seen
question.
It. I've not seen it, and here's my excuse, if there is one here. I'll bore you guys with data. Hopefully the listeners won't tune off here. There's close to 500 scripted television programs this year. Back in 2002, when Bob mentioned The Wire, when that was on the air, there was 180 of them. So we're almost triple the number in just the last 17 years of the number of television shows.
What is the saturation point likely to be on that, Todd? That's got to be close, right?
That's the question. John Landgraf, the head of FX Networks, has coined this phrase, peak television, P-E-A-K. where it's just not going to be sustainable. It's going to be that saturation point. There's too much. People can't watch it. The shows won't be able to be sustained. They're going to get canceled, even if we enjoy them very much. And we tend to see that. Maybe not as much as usual or not less than usual, but we might have hit that point now. Back in the day, and I keep referring to something like The Wire and The Sopranos, you have something like five people in the state of New York watching The Wire, and two of them are on the show right now here. I mean, that should tell you something, right? But now it's, well, hey, you guys watch Dairy Girls? I didn't. What else you got? And it's okay. It's not as horrible as it was back then.
Okay, but I do want you to know that you're making a bad decision with your life and not watching the Dairy Girls.
Well, I was invited to be on the show, so I was going to watch it at noon
today. Oh, painful. So Dairy Girls.
By the way, your audience should know that one of the greatest television shows of all time, by the opinion of almost every critic, is, of course, The Sopranos, right? Nobody puts that below at least the top five. And your guest today, Professor Todd Sedano, actually appeared not only in an episode of Sopranos, but the really important episode of The Sopranos.
Well, since you just lofted that alley-oop, let me slam that down the hoop there with great thunder like Evan's favorite player, LeBron James, would do. Now, there was an episode of The Sopranos that involved a really, really violent scene, where one of the exotic dancers of the Bada Bing Gentlemen's Club was brutally murdered by Joe Pantoliano's character. And I was an extra in that particular episode. I didn't know that I was going to be in that particular episode until the episode aired that particular night. And the reason this got all sorts of notoriety was that NBC, the head of NBC at the time, Robert Wright, sent a memo to his people at the network saying, how do we compete with this? How do we compete with the sex, the violence, the language that The Sopranos has?
And the answer was Todd Sedano?
It always is.
Oh. But Todd is under, I mean, he's right. That Robert Wright memo, what does network TV do now that we have The Sopranos?
Interesting.
Was one of the biggest questions that solidified in one sentence the big change that happened as we moved from the era of the flying nun and the talking horses and the my mother the cars to something entirely different. And Robert Wright, who was by no means a programming genius, he didn't know what to do with Hill Street Blues or St. Elsewhere or any of that stuff, which, by the way, started all this quality TV. But he did have the right question. He took a look at that, and he said, how do we possibly compete? And you know how they compete with it? They're making remakes of Family Feud and Kids Say the Darndest Things and Ninja Warrior and all the rest of it. America's Got Talent, which goes back to 19th century vaudeville. But we can make fun of that stuff. But if you look at the top 25 highest rated shows of last season, they tend to all be network shows, many of which are ideas that have been around for 40 years. America's Funniest Home Videos debuted in 1989. That was in the top 25.
Wow.
And for the younger listeners, the talking horse and the talking car and all that, Bob's making references to actual television shows.
And the only...
The Flying Nun was a sitcom and a hit about a nun who flied and protected orphans. And not only that, it starred a two-time Oscar winner, Sally Field. By the way, she did not win her Oscars for Flying Nun.
They didn't really like her.
Oh, my gosh. Right
now. Well, the only game show of past years of any popularity that I have not seen reinvented in some way in recent years has been Match Game. And maybe I'm wrong. Maybe there is a recent Match Game.
Yes, there is a recent Match Game.
Oh, there is, of course.
Yes.
There is. Because I was going to say...
Complete with the really, really long, thin microphone.
The Gene Rayburn microphone.
The Gene Rayburn microphone.
If you've ever wondered if we needed a Me Too movement, go back and watch Match Game, you know, from the 60s and 70s. And
oh, no.
Well, I'm just... The way...
Go back and watch Seinfeld if you want to see that we need a... There's a Seinfeld episode where he actually gives sleeping medication to a woman so that she goes to sleep so he can play with her antique toy collection. I'm not kidding. That's a real episode of Seinfeld.
I have not. I've seen almost every Seinfeld, and I think that's not ringing a bell.
Evan's flummoxed.
I always flummoxed. I didn't know if he was euphemizing. But anyway, the point is, yeah, Match Game. Of course, there's a new Match Game. There's a new everything. Why do they do that, Bob? Why are we unable to sort of let things set on the shelf, Family Feud, and say you can enjoy it on YouTube, but you know that's that.
It's not like we're unable to. It's just that these other properties still have value to them. We still make many, many productions of Shakespeare every year, as we should. Shakespeare is good. It continues to work. Match Game was a funny format. The Gong Show was a funny format. The idea of bringing it up to date with new people makes sense. The reason we're seeing so much of this isn't because nobody else has any other ideas, because look around streaming and cable. There are plenty new ideas out there. But there's so much real estate that we've got the new ideas. We've got the sophisticated literary stuff. But there's also room for Family Feud and Let's Make a Deal and Jeopardy and all these things that go back to my childhood. And interestingly enough, most of those shows are getting way, way, way more viewers than all this fancy literary stuff that Todd and I like so much.
And they're bringing back Supermarket Sweep, which was popular. Who's hosting the remake of that, Megan Mack? Leslie Jones? Leslie Jones is going to host the new Supermarket
Sweep. Right, Leslie Jones, who's now left Saturday Night Live. And they're also bringing back Kids Say the Darndest Things, which Art Linkletter started doing on television in 1948, before anybody even had a television. Tiffany Haddish is going to do that, which I'm really looking forward to it. But do you remember who did, between Art Linkletter and Tiffany Haddish, who did the second remake of Kids Say the Darndest Thing?
Uh-oh, Professor Sedano.
I think my microphone's not working. Yeah. I think, Bob, you got this
one. What's the answer, Bob?
None other than Bill Cosby.
Oh, I should have known that.
Bill Cosby doing a show talking to a bunch of little kids. That reads a little differently now than it did.
It certainly does. Yes, it certainly does. So let's talk about what's good right now. And Todd, you mentioned earlier you like Barry on HBO.
Yes. I like Barry on HBO. I like Succession on HBO and Years and Years, which was a BBC One show that had something on HBO, or it just aired on HBO for six episodes. And the nice thing about these shows, just tying back into what we were talking about earlier in the hour, is that these kinds of series, if you're catching them in the middle and you have that week to week, you're able to make a recommendation to a friend or to a radio host and say, hey, guess what? Barry's a great show. You should watch it. Or Succession. It's only in the middle of its second season. Then you have the opportunity to catch up. But if there's that full drop and you only have an opportunity to watch it at your leisure, where you can binge or cannot binge, it often just sits on that shelf in the ether where you may not get that chance.
Okay. Bob, what do you like?
All those are great choices. Barry, this last season, did an episode with this kind of, I don't know how you describe her, a little ninja kid.
That was brilliant.
Of the most trippy things I have ever seen on a television screen. And it just went on and on and on. Years and Years, I highly recommend, unless you have a tendency towards anxiety, and then I don't recommend it because it is very, very disturbing. We don't know when it's going to come back, but I think Atlanta is one of the greatest series to come out in a long, long time. Insecure, I think, is doing some really, really interesting things. And on the OWN, Oprah Winfrey's network, we're in, I think, halfway through a show called David Makes Man, which I think is the best thing the Oprah Winfrey Network has finally found a drama that both adheres to Oprah's kind of, you know, zeitgeist, and at the same time is actually really, it's kind of like the Wonder Years, but it takes place in a very different context.
You want to jump in there? Go ahead.
Yeah, Bob mentioned two shows there, Atlanta and Insecure, featuring showrunners and creators who are African-American, which is good for storytelling. It's good to diversify that pot of storytellers these days. Donald Glover, he's not the showrunner, I don't think, but that is his show on FX, which Bob got renewed, I think I heard recently, for a third and a fourth season.
When he gets around to making it.
Right, when he's not cutting records and acting and
being Simba.
And Lando Calrissian, wasn't he?
Was he?
I think he was.
I think you're right.
He has had an extraordinary, and not to mention This Is America. I mean, he's become this guy who played a, you know, kind of mild-mannered role on Community has become an American television mogul, movie mogul.
Yeah. Yeah, so
for good reason. He does some really extraordinary work.
Just looking at some of listener feedback, Emily on Twitter says, we are terrible at binging shows. Russian Doll is 8 episodes. We've been watching for more than 2 weeks. I've only stayed awake for 2 episodes. Chris,
wait, 2 weeks, 8 episodes? That's not binging.
That's not binging.
That's sleeping.
I agree. Chris on Twitter says, I mostly binge watch shows on streaming services, but I've moved a lot of my viewing time to YouTube in the past year. Or so. YouTube.
So I got flack from a student in class last week for not recognizing YouTube as a legitimate platform, which you can pay for, which you can get all sorts of content on. So I need to do my homework and find out what the hubbub is.
And just apart from streaming service or watching so-called shows, YouTube is where a lot of young adults are getting news from. And we are at our peril if we ignore the YouTube impact there.
That's true, and that's a good point to make, because I still think of YouTube as David after dentist. Leave Britney alone.
Yeah.
Sneezing panda. Cats playing pianos. And YouTube has obviously, since it started in April of 2005, gone considerably further than that.
Yeah. And you guys have touched on this earlier, too, in terms of just the plethora of platforms we have out there. I mean, this is costing people a lot of money. Now, back in the day, Bob, correct me if I'm wrong, was it Senator John McCain who was looking to go a la carte with cable?
Oh, yeah, a lot of people, but he was one of them.
And it sounded like a great idea. I'm paying X hundred dollars a month or every few months for, you know, a few hundred channels. Why don't I get to choose the ones I want? Well, now you're getting to fish your wish, but look how much you're paying. You're going to pay $17 for HBO Now. You're going to pay $7 for Disney Plus. You're going to pay maybe $30 for Sling so you can get your ESPN. And by the time you're done, you're paying more than you paid for your cable bill, and you're getting many, many fewer hundred channels.
I think that is the most important point made in this entire hour, because I think you are absolutely right. There's this idea that we cut the cord only to, in fact, establish a bill that was as much or more as it was before we cut it. It just comes in to us in a different way.
I would like to have the courage to cut all the cords, but, you know.
I haven't been able to yet.
Yeah, but I mean,
me neither.
But we're older than a lot of the youngs who are listening.
That's right.
You know, the youngs have figured that out. Teresa says, writes to say, the Bob Newhart show was the best final episode ever. Andrew says, in my opinion, the only good thing about the Seinfeld finale was that it was the end of the series. I didn't like those jerks in the first place. So,
well, the final episode bore that out, so he should have been happy with it.
They were supposed to be jerks. I think that's exactly the point that we're getting at here. As we get ready to close the hour, Bob Thompson, for you, what is the most interesting stuff that's being made now? And I say interesting because, you know, I think about the show. Christina Applegate was in this sort of dark show. What was that called? Yeah, I can't read your lips. Megan Mack is trying to tell me through the glass, because it's one of the few shows I have seen. Dead to Me was the show that Christina Applegate stars, and it was interesting, but it was basically junk food. And I binged it because I could. But if it was week to week, I think I would have thought about it in the same way that Bob thought about the Lost finale, and I would have went like, what am I doing here? But I binged it. But it wasn't, you know, it was sort of fun junk food for a moment. It was sugary high. It wasn't all that interesting. What's interesting, Bob? What's catching your eye now?
Well, I think the most interesting thing about where we are right now, and I think Todd is right that this may not be a sustainable model, but that there is just so much good stuff out there. Just in the last weeks, I finished up that Roger Ailes thing, which was
Russell Crowe.
Yeah, with Russell Crowe, right? There is just so much good stuff out there, and if you run out of good new stuff, which you can't possibly do, there's available all of the good stuff for the entire history of the medium. I mean, when I went into this field in 1980. I didn't even have a VCR. I had to watch stuff when it was on the air. The bounty, the amount of really good stuff, the amount of really horrible stuff, the amount of everything has so increased that this is by far the most exciting period for television content we've ever been in. How this is all going to play out 5 years, 10 years from now is going to be interesting to see. But even if it all collapses 5 years from now, think of the amount of good programming that has been committed to film and tape in the last even 5 years. It's absolutely breathtaking.
Yeah, if we have lots of rainy and snowy days ahead of us, there's plenty to consume.
Right. Well, if, of course, we've got electricity and infrastructure, which is looking less and less likely.
That's on that sunny note, Bob Thompson.
Yeah, right, exactly.
Picked us right up there, Bob.
Yeah. A hop in my step as we end the hour. Bob's the director of the Blyer Center for Television and Popular Culture at the Newhouse School at Syracuse University. If you have missed the previous conversations involving Bob Thompson, they're easily tagged, and you can binge them whenever you like. Or maybe just set one aside per week. You know, when you got a chance to sit down and enjoy connections. Bob, thanks. It's always good to have you.
Always my pleasure. Thank you.
Todd Sedano, Associate Professor of Media and Communication at St. John Fisher College. Thank you, sir. Great
Thank
to have
you,
your
Evan.
Expertise here. And a short break, more connections coming up.